Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we talk about the culture we love that society sometimes makes us feel ashamed of. My name is Caroline O'Donoghue, and I'm that feeling you get after a one-night stand where you'd rather chew your arm off than wake him. Joining me is Russian teaser who can't fight the moonlight, Hannah Rose Woods. You're not Russian, but are you a tease?
I'm not sure.
Sorry, what a horrible question to come in on.
I think in the film, the Russian tease is told that she's not allowed to be a slut if she is also a tease. So there's a dilemma there, apparently.
I think those two concepts can exist at once. Yeah. So today you're bringing to the garbage truck Coyote Ugly.
I am, my problematic fave.
Oh, it's so good, though. Tell me what made you choose it.
I mean, it is in some ways genuine garbage and it is incredibly sentimental, but I have a real soft spot for it and I kind of want to rehabilitate it as a cultural artifact from like a very specific point in like kind of Y2K, early noughties.
Yes, completely. I think it occupies a really strange but important waypoint of the like feminism's journey between girl power, like after girl power, and pre-Catlin Moran.
Yeah.
I see that as being very much an era of like, where it's like where the word ladette was suddenly a thing. The idea of being a page three girl was kind of lightly aspirational. People were always calling Katie Price an amazing businesswoman. And it was like this thing of like hypersexuality, sex tapes, the idea that Paris Hilton would make money off her own sex tape was a thing. This idea of like hypersexuality being this thing that you could own and possess, and that was a feminist act because, and I kind of think it represents these sort of two ideas of feminism, doesn't it? Because there's one form of feminism that is, I think, much more current, which is it is our job to change the world and change how the world sees women. And then there's this other kind of feminism that's a bit, I guess you could call it streetwise, which is like men are pigs and men will always find a way to monetize our sexuality. So if we own the store kind of thing, it's empowering. And I feel like this movie, I'm not going to say it explores that because I think that gives it more credit than it's due.
I think the film is not quite sure what kind of feminism it's about. I think it definitely presents itself as a tale of empowerment.
Yes.
And a kind of raunchier brand of girl power. I think it prefigured so much in noughties culture, like kind of Dirty Era Christina, everyone wearing thongs, everyone having like a Playboy little, you know, dangling thing on their phone case.
Yes.
And I think it offered this like incredibly, I think it genuinely meant well, this brand of like, I mean, so-called stiletto feminism.
Yeah.
But I think it offered this genuinely naive, optimistic vision of the social contract where I think they just said, well, okay, women, has it occurred to you that, you know, you can simply be both very feminine, very girly, dance very beautifully, also have this kind of like hard, kind of bro-y, badass edge where, you know, you drink men under the table. If they threaten you at any point, you just fell them with a quip. You just have to be like quicker and wittier than they are.
Yeah.
You know, you can like dominate them with your sexuality, kind of keep yourself in the gaze. And like, that's how you overcome patriarchy. Just be better than men, like in every single possible way, whilst also very feminine.
Yeah. Stronger, hotter, better, can play pool, can do everything. Yeah, exactly. You have to be able to hang yourself upside down by your feet on a pipe, and then you can have equality.
I think when Violet, Piper Perabo, when she first walks into the bar and she gets like her like trial shift, the manager says to her, look, you just have to look available all the time but never be available.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is it, isn't it? And it's like that is, and it's weird because it's not quite a strip club. It's not quite Hooters.
Mm.
It is kind of both. But like, I think it also, it's this thing of, it's this kind of genre of movie that I don't think is given, you know how the way a horror movie is meant to be predictable and a horror movie is meant to be schlocky, it's meant to have these certain waypoints where like the killer arrives, the victim, you know, they have all these genre signposts, right? I think Coyote Ugly exists in a different kind of unofficial genre, which is the sleepover movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is like, the idea of a sleepover movie, it's not to be original. It's like, I'm counting sort of, Glitter is a sleepover movie, Coyote Ugly, Crossroads, the Britney Spears film, Burlesque, they're all the same film. They're all like, young woman with a dead mother has a dream.
But I do think it's extraordinary that like, it became a sleepover film, which it very much is. You know, it's based on, very loosely based on a GQ article by Elizabeth Gilbert, like pre-Pray Love, who wrote about working in this bar. And it was when she was still in her very kind of like imitating Hemingway mode. Yes. And she was very interested in like hyper-masculine culture.
Yeah.
And she like described the piece as kind of, she aimed it as like a Charles Bukowski type short story from a woman's perspective. Where she kind of like was talking to these like regulars in the bar, like, do you know that this is how we see you?
Yes, yes.
But I think she said she was absolutely astounded when she kind of saw that it was being aimed at a preteen audience, because as far as she was concerned, it was, you know, about, the story was about the kind of like ineffable, indefinable like charisma and magic of what makes a good bar.
Yeah.
And it was an incredibly kind of adult male vision.
And very much like an alcoholic culture. Do you know what I mean? She talks about regulars and she talks about like, and I'm sure I'll be reading from bits of that GQ article, which was published in 97, I think. This idea of like, yes, you could call everybody in this bar lowlifes and losers, but I was a lowlife. I was a loser. Yeah. I was heartbroken. This was my life. The fact that I could be sort of queen of this gutter meant everything to me. And this is all entrenched deeply in kind of alcoholism, right? And like the idea that these women and their sexuality would squeeze these alcoholics for as much as they possibly could. And they relied on regulars. And that doesn't exist in the film. Yeah. Alcohol doesn't even really exist in the film. Do you know what I mean? Which I find fascinating. Like, it's there as a prop, but like no one's ever drunk. None of the girls are ever drunk.
I just can't believe, like, Jerry Bruckheimer, the producer, kind of just saw this story and thought, like, this will inspire preteen girls.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, like, fair enough, alcohol isn't centred, but definitely, like, sexuality is very centred.
Yes.
In a way that's not intuitive to pitch to a preteen girl audience.
Yeah.
Kind of performing the male gaze to each other.
Yeah, totally. If you think of this as, like, on the VHS, you know, shelf next to like Save the Last Dance and that kind of thing. Like, yeah, it's sort of like, you know, if Britney Spears' Crossroads is a Barbie doll, then this is the Bratz Dolls.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It has a very Bratz Dolls energy.
I mean, like, I think I was like 10 when the film came out, and I probably watched it on DVD when I was a little bit older, but I definitely wasn't a teenager. But I think it did, it sounds so strange to say it now, but I think it did genuinely seem kind of revolutionary.
Yes, it did.
Because I think so much of like teen and preteen girly culture was like very saturated with like Britney Spears, like she's a virgin, she's the good girl.
Yeah.
Or you could be Christina Aguilera, she's like the bad slut you want. And like there was that very clear dichotomy.
Yes.
And what I quite like about this film is how genuinely sincere and sentimental it is. Like, Piper still, Violet, the character played by Piper Perabo, she still remains this, like, very sweet, nice person.
Yeah.
She's, like, still in touch with her friends from her, you know, small town New Jersey upbringing. There's no sense that she has to, like, become a different person to embrace kind of raunchy sexuality. That it's just something that, you know, she just enjoys doing and it brings her out of her shell.
And it is, I do find it quite nice.
Yeah.
There's this whole thing of like, she's this gifted songwriter, but she's too shy to ever perform, and she's like quite mealy mouthed in general.
Mm.
And the idea of like, oh, finding confidence through bartending, it's quite fun. I'm going to do a plot summary. Okay. Coyote Ugly is a 2000 movie about an aspiring songwriter, Violet, who moved to New York and quickly begins working at Coyote Ugly, a rowdy bar that is owned and run by women. Coyote Ugly is aggressively sexual. And while not quite a strip club, the girls dance on the bar, flirt with customers, and generally do hot girl shit. Violet tries to pursue her career as a songwriter while working at the bar and finding love. But is working at the bar helping Violet gain confidence or consuming her identity completely? And when I wrote that plot summary, because it's quite hard, like I was trying to explain this film to my boyfriend yesterday, and he'd only seen the music video with Leanne Rimes dancing in the moonlight. Dancing in the moonlight? Can't fight the moonlight. and he was like, "What? It's just about a bunch of women who own a bar and they get rowdy." And I was like,
"Kind of.
Yeah, that's it. That is kind of it." But there are so many, like, this is one of those movies that I kind of would love to see remade in the way that Elizabeth Gilbert intended it.
You know, they're thinking of making a sequel. Tyra Banks desperately wants the sequel to happen, but I think everyone else is not quite sure how they would update it for, like, the feminism of 2020s. But I genuinely think it's at least four films.
Yes, yes.
Like, on the one hand, it's this very straightforward, like, American dream Cinderella fairy tale of sweet small town girl that has a dream of making it in the big city. Mm-hmm. You know, they've also, like, you know, there's a romance in there with, like, this impossibly beautiful guy played by Adam Garcia who just looks like a baby John Travolta. There's
Kevin
this very, like,
O'Donnell.
Saturday Night Fever vibe.
Yeah,
but then it's also, like, a coming-of-age tale about her relationship with her father.
Yes.
And then it's also, like, a kind of girl power, women running the show film as well.
Yes, yes. And it's also this story about, like... And I do think that central question would have been so... could have made for a really, like, properly good film if it was, like, the idea of, like, is this enabling you to be a more confident person and put yourself out there more and all that? Or is it just, like, consuming your identity? There's a part towards the end of the movie where they have that inevitable third act, no one's talking to her moment. Mm. And Kevin is... I long for a day when romantic leads were just called Kevin. It's mad to me.
He collects comic books.
I know. Apparently in the original draft, he was actually supposed to be, like, you know, involved in seedy drug culture. Mm. But they went, teenagers.
He'll be dealing in comic books.
He'll be dealing in comic books. He's like, oh, this is, like, a place for you to, like, put your head in the sand and not be a real singer-songwriter, a real artist kind of thing. And I was like, oh, that is the most interesting version, I think, of the film.
Yeah.
Is someone dissolving into this lifestyle and forgetting what they came to the city for. Which is how I would rewrite it.
Yeah. I'd rewrite it as women running the show.
Really?
I think it's so interesting to compare it to Hustlers.
Yes, I love Hustlers.
I think that's the film it would be if it was made now.
Yes.
Because I wish they'd explored the kind of darker side of women reclaiming their sexuality.
Yeah.
Like, just if they delved a bit more into the morality of, is it, like, is it utopian to kind of treat men like crap? You
know? I believe
it is.
Is
that what
quality
looks like? Like, you know, we accept objectification, but we also treat you like crap.
Yes. That's it. That's, you found it. It's utopia. I don't know if you want to talk about the earlier parts of the movie, but for me, it really begins when she's in that diner with her last, like, $2 eating her apple pie. And then the coyotes come in and they're all reading Playboy.
Mm.
And Tyra Banks is, like, on her last shift, basically. And, like...
just, like, looking unbelievably luminous.
Unbelievable.
She has, like, three scenes in that film.
Yeah, I know. But she's so a big part of the cultural consensus of that movie. And it's so weird because, like, we've done America's Next Top Model episode. I feel like Tyra Banks is a woman of, like, highly, like, it's like she has a bipolar disorder for charisma. Do you know, but just for charisma. Like, sometimes she's the most charismatic person ever, and sometimes she's like a wooden human created by robots and you don't know what you're going to get, and it kind of oscillates so much. But this version of Tyra Banks, I kind of forgot it existed. She's so natural and so gorgeous and so fun,
and she just looks like she exists in, like, a higher definition to all the people around her, and everyone in the film is beautiful.
God, they're so gorgeous. And this, like, when you just see them and she's there, like, the styling is so expert in this. I think we both read the same oral history that was in The Ringer by Kate Lloyd. So well compiled, really long. I really recommend everyone get it together. But they use the stylist on the movie was Madonna's stylist.
Yeah.
And that makes so much sense. Mm. The styling in this movie is incredible. This thing of like having Violet's character be very like Laura Ashley, very cardigans, like not unattractive and not, you don't, when you meet the character, you don't think of her as dressing in a dowdy way, but then you see her comparatively. It is like a pigeon and parakeets, isn't it? Mm. And just like the leopard print, like skin tight chaps and the like the little fluffy crop tops and leather halters. Mm. And when you see them, it is just like these creatures. They're so, that to me, like when I think of this as like my early sleepover memories and watching this movie, to me, that's act one, scene one. Like that's how, when it opens, it's such a,
I think the fashion, like its influence has been under-acknowledged culturally.
Yes, yes.
Like everything they're wearing in that film, it looks like you could just buy from Pretty Little Thing or Misguided now.
Everything they're wearing has been advertised to me on an Instagram advert for, what's that horrible shop called again? Is it Cider? I don't know. But yeah, it's like that. It's like the same idea of the fashion in Clueless, but like turned up, the contrast turned up way high and given the sort of masculine rock star type,
like
of
biker edge. Dystopia.
Biker or biker utopia almost. And it's like, and this idea as well that like, and I think I internalize this, of the fact that they're all reading Playboy on their, like they come off this sort of like, you know, 8 or 10 hour shift. It's like 3 or 4 in the morning and they're reading Playboy. I have really like, I don't know. Were you the kind of teen girl who really, you know, bought into that kind of ladette culture and that thing of reading Nuts magazine and Zoo? Because I definitely was.
I think I internalized it
in
a way that it has taken me like years to unpick the extent.
Yes. Yeah. Like I used to read those magazines and they would always be like a girl intern character almost. Mm. There would always be like some girl who's like wearing a button down and doing the Agony Aunt column or something, or like they would show pictures of the offices and there would always be like one very hot blonde girl hanging out being a lad, and that was just my fantasy.
I'm not like other girls.
Exactly, which is so funny because as we mentioned Elizabeth Gilbert a minute ago, like, and that part of her career, this thing of her being this kind of proto Hemingway character. Like I'm a huge fan of hers and I've done 2 episodes on her and I will probably do a third. But it was a very annoying part of her career.
Yeah.
Of like, even that article is about all her regulars being in love with her and how she's just so effortless and how she dances on the bar and stuff. It's like quite annoying.
She's like, you know, you all watched me. I think she kind of repeatedly in the article, she's like, I wasn't the prettiest girl in the bar, but I was the one everyone looked to.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think just noughties culture did have a really ambivalent relationship to girliness. I think that there was a very seductive promise of a very feminine girl that behaved like men.
Yeah. But in the right way.
Yeah.
It was like, yes, she drinks beers and yes, it's the cool girl thing all over again. It's often, like, she drinks beer and she eats hot dogs and she loves baseball, but she doesn't shit.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
And then I think, like, when's Gone Girl? Is that like 10 years after Coyote Ugly? It's turned so, the dream has turned so dark and sour compared to like the optimistic Disney narrative.
The dream, and the dream is definitely centered and it's most heightened in that Bridget Moynihan character, who of course we all know went on to play Natasha in Sex and the City. I don't know if you're a Sex and the City fan, are you?
No, I'm not.
Oh no, I saw your eyes flicker and I was like, oh no, she knows she's in trouble.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Based on this sighting of the coyotes, she kind of overhears that Tyra Banks is leaving her job to go to law school, which is like very much like the scriptwriter putting a point on it, isn't it? Like, these girls are clever too. They go to law school. And then she seeks out Lil, who I think is the only insert from the original piece that Elizabeth Gilbert wrote in that GQ thing. And she's like rough and tough. And she's like, I think she described in that Elizabeth Gilbert piece as having like being blonde and having the body of a figure skater.
Yeah.
Which is definitely translates and covered in tattoos. And it's like, oh, she's like holding around crates and she's like, yeah, this is my space. And what I found quite interesting was the thing, first thing she asks her is, do you do drugs?
Yeah.
And then she says, show me your arms. Mm. And I never got it until this watching that she's looking for tracks.
Yeah.
Which is quite like...
Well, I heard that the script for the film went through like many, many redrafts.
Yes. Yes.
Well, I think you were saying that, you know, it was going to be like originally like Kevin wasn't going to be involved in a drug deal. But, you know, it turns out to be in the redraft a comic book deal.
Yes.
But I think there are these wisps of like this dark in New York.
Yeah.
Like pre-gentrification meatpacking district.
Yes.
That the script just kind of, it's almost like they just forgot to edit that out when they went to go for a properly sentimental sleepover film.
It's so true. And like there, as it says in that Ringer article, Kevin Smith did a draft.
Yeah.
Carrie Fisher did a draft.
Yeah.
Like even Kevin Smith in that oral history is so interesting on it. Kevin Smith is obviously the director of Clerks and Chasing Amy and, you know, kind of like...
Stoner bro,
kind of edgy comedy, really owned early noughties, you know, sort of bro comedies before Judd Apatow came and took over. But he kind of talks about how it was amazing to him that it was about women. The article was written by a woman. The original first draft of the script was done by a woman. And then he says, and then the men just took over.
Yeah.
It's so interesting because it's like that. It's so visible because you can see all these drafts layered on top of each other. The track marks, and Kevin Smith says the one line that has remained from his script, and he got paid $100K for, was the moment where Violet says to who's the Russian tease, Kimmy?
Oh God, I honestly don't know. I know of
their names. It's very Spice Girls, very like the Russian one,
yeah,
the mean one, the Tyra Banks one. She says, "Oh, I think I'm in love with you," you know, offhandedly. And then I think it's Kimmy turns around to her and says, "Oh, Violet, I'm not a lesbian. I played in the minors, but I never went pro," which is a really funny line.
It is funny. But I think, so I genuinely, when I rewatched this film, I was expecting to find it more problematic than I actually did find. I thought this is going to be a relic of like a very, very different time, which it is.
Yeah.
But it's not, it doesn't feel fundamentally dodgy. Like its heart's in the right place, but there is such, there's like this one throwaway moment as well as that where like Violet goes to hand in, you know, she has this like ridiculous idea of how she's going to like make it in the industry where she just turns up at record companies with some tapes and she's like, can I meet your CEO to like play on this tape?
I got a tape.
And there's this awful line where a receptionist is like, look, like lady, I've got problems in my life.
I love that monologue though.
But she's like, I know I've got like this going on and that going on. And like my daughter's just said she's bisexual. As if it's like just another like terrible thing that's happened in her life.
No, I just so thought, like, weird.
What is this? Like, what is this film's relationship to sexuality?
What indeed? Because it does go out of its way to tell you that Violet has sex.
It's completely heterosexual. And the two moments that gay people are acknowledged, it's just like a throwaway punchline, just like a bit of pep to the script.
A little bit of seasoning, a little bit of something. That monologue though from that receptionist is so funny. It's so well delivered. It's like, oh, where is her TV show? Because the way she delivers that line, which is a really odd line, is like, and then she tells me that she is a bisexual. Now, please, I am dying to know how I can make your dreams come true. So nuts. So funny to me.
There are so many funny women in that film, which I'd kind of forgotten about. I hadn't realised until I rewatched it that like there are so many like people that have become subsequently famous, like female comedians in the audience.
Yes. What, that girl from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia is there. Like, it's such a grab bag of random people. Like, Melanie Lynskey, who plays her best friend, is like a very celebrated indie actress. John Goodman, obviously.
Yeah, what is John Goodman doing in that film? Like, I'm so pleased he's there.
but why is he
did
there?
Did he just take a paycheck?
I just feel like, yeah, like at that point he was playing these sort of surly, big working class dads so much. He was like, what's another one? It's 2 days out of my life.
He's so lovely in that film, though.
Do you think?
I like him.
I found him quite a dark character this time around.
Did you?
Yeah.
I have to say, I think Violet totally enables any of his problematic side.
Yeah.
Where when she's like about to leave for New York and she's like, don't do laundry. Like, you know, you're terrible at it. Like, I'll come back and do it. And like, don't try and cook. Like, I filled the freezer with meals.
Yeah.
And I think at one point he says, like, aren't I supposed to be the adult, like, telling you how to go and like live your life in New York?
I hate the dynamic. I find it very chilling, the dynamic. Because it's
tell me.
Because it's this thing of like, it's like so codependent. Mm. It reminds me of the Atessa Mashfeg novel, Eileen, where it's just like she's like insisting that he can't live without her, but she's leaving him. And she's he's insisting that she can't go and she shouldn't go and just don't go. And
I just kind of felt he was like play acting, being gruff with that. Like,
yes, but then he reveals later on that he crushed her mother's dreams.
He did. I forgot about that.
Okay, so when she shows up for her audition, and I feel like she has about 15 shifts in this bar before she actually works there properly, I just laughed so much when Lil tears the arms off.
Yeah.
So stupid. And then what happens at her audition?
Well, she's introduced as Jersey because she's not allowed to be called Violet because that's not sexy enough.
Boring, yeah.
She's escaped from a convent, apparently,
yes.
And she's tired of being the only virgin in New York City. And then the crowd cheers.
Yeah, and it's this fantasy of just like, they're all line dancing on the bar. It's like proper Broadway numbers that they're on the bar. And when you read the kind of the oral history of how they did all those scenes, and they are absolutely, like, I've written my notes here. Oh, it's fun though, isn't it? Because it is. There's so much energy and verve. And like, it really renders the rest of the movie, like kind of the love plot and the dad plot and even the singing plot sort of a bit flabby because it's just, you just kind of want the whole thing to be montages of her trying on clothes and just the bar, you know?
She's just so intoxicated by like the prospect of joining these women that just have fun all the time.
Yeah. She doesn't pass her initial audition, but then she breaks up a fight with her $10.
She does. She refuses to line dance because she doesn't know the steps,
yeah.
Which is absolutely fair enough.
Fair.
Those are incredibly choreographed dances.
Very
and she's dismissed for not knowing the line dancing moves.
Is that why she's dismissed?
Yeah. She says she's not going to get up and dance until she knows the steps.
Which seems utterly fair enough. And then she breaks up a fight with her $10. And then she's allowed a second audition.
Because she might have a bit of badass in her after
she
all.
She might, after all. Lil sees something in her. And then she goes for the clothes trying on montage, which I love.
Oh,
I love all those clothes
I
so
want
much.
Everything.
Everything. When Kimmy tries on that sort of Chinese silk split thigh dress. Honestly, every single thing I want.
And they're all Instagram outfits.
They're all Instagram outfits. They really are. I loved it. And then there's like, I always laugh at it so much. When she's like wearing a sleeveless t-shirt and a midi skirt, looks in the mirror and says, forgive me, Father, for
I have sinned.
It's like, how? What? It's like, the film really maintains that what they're doing is really controversial.
Yeah.
Like, they're fully clothed, they're serving drinks, and occasionally they get up on the bar. But it really maintains that it's like a very transgressive act. It's such a pre-9/11 film.
I do think, though, given that it is clearly a sleepover film, it's like 100% a chick flick.
Yeah.
It does try and be all things to all people, though, because when she's in the mirror with that midi skirt, there's just like some very gratuitous bits where she's like wearing these very this very small G-string.
Yes.
And the camera is like lingering over her like...
Yes.
Taking her clothes off. And I just think, like, no, like, this film is for girls. Like,
we don't need that. Yeah, it's so weird that, like, she's the most conservatively dressed of all the coyotes, but we get so many things of her, like, a lavender thong. Do you know what I mean? Just, like, hanging around her bedroom. Why?
Yeah, like, putting chopsticks in her hair and just, like, sashaying around.
Yeah.
On her own.
On her own, just feeling herself. Is it, like, okay, is there anything artistically relevant in all those like sexy violet scenes?
No, I genuinely just think that's gratuitous Hollywood filmmaking.
There's not this thing of like, oh, you know, when she actually privately is a sexual person. No, we think it's just no. Irrelevant.
I genuinely don't think so.
No, I agree. I just wanted to see if there was something in it. What do you think of her songwriting?
I mean, I absolutely love those scenes where she's like in her little rooftop songwriting area and she's got all these candles in the New York skyline that somehow haven't blown out at any point. She's just in her little, she's in her zone composing. I love it.
I love it too. Then the like, when that thing of like, oh, she's, you know, she's using her urban environment to create. And like, she sees a guy doing like hip hop dancing in his bedroom.
She's like, oh, multiculturalism. I can incorporate this.
I know. Also this thing of like, she lives in Chinatown. Where are the Chinese people?
Yeah, it is an incredibly white New York. But I mean, that is just very, yeah, I think, of a piece for like noughties filmmaking.
Yes, it really, really is. But I just love those songs so much. And like, this is quite embarrassing, but... I was learning guitar around this time, and this really, and I'd forgotten it until I watched it this time, because I was writing a lot of songs like quite early and young and stuff, and not showing them to people, and I always credit that to like an obsession with Avril Lavigne and Alanis Morissette and people like that, but I had actually forgotten until this viewing how much that sort of like identity was formed by Violet on her roof. The loving you in the
I feel terrible for her. Apparently she learnt to play guitar for the film. She took like vocal lessons and wanted to record all of it. And I think they did record all the tracks, and then they listened to it and they were like, we might like overdub Leanne Rimes.
I know.
I think she was terribly disappointed.
Piper Perabo is someone I really wonder about. You know, like, it's funny because I was reading the Roger Ebert review of this movie. And he didn't like it, which is fairly obvious why.
I don't think any of the critics liked it at the time. I think it got some, like, hideous reviews.
It really did. And, like, most of those reviews are quite fair.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
They're not wrong.
They're not wrong. But there's something he says towards the end is like, you know, this will be sort of like a footnote in Piper Perabo's what I'm sure will be an illustrious screen career. It's quite sad because it wasn't. Like, this is what we know Piper Perabo for, you know?
They did her dirty.
They did her dirty. And, like, she's one of those actors who... And Samantha Mathis is another one where I always look at her and think, like, did you refuse to have sex with the wrong people?
Oh, God.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's what it feels like. It's like you are in this huge movie, everything to play for.
And she is incredible.
She's great.
Yeah.
She carries the movie. And it's like, it's a bit like that Anne Hathaway role in The Devil Wears Prada, where it's like, it's a boring role, and it's the entire point of the role is so, you know, other characters, bigger charisma can bounce off of you and you can be wide-eyed about it. And so it's a really hard type of role to pull off. And she does it, and she's like compelling, and you want to be her when you're a teenager, and, you know?
I definitely did.
Yeah. That hair.
Yeah.
Yeah, she has this kind of like, sort of, Julia Roberts-y type of part.
She does look so much like Julia Roberts in that film.
Yes. Her and Amanda Potter, who was in Head Over Heels, were both doing kind of a Julia Roberts impersonation thing.
Which I guess does mean Elizabeth Gilbert has been played twice by Julia Roberts-ish.
Oh my God, very true. One thing I like about, I both like it and I'm confused by it, considering they overdubbed all of Piper Parabo's vocals. I like that Violet's vocals are fine.
Yeah.
She's a fine voice.
But she doesn't want to be a singer. You know, she's like reluctantly singing. Yeah, she just wants to songwrite.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Which I really like.
I quite like that because I feel like, wasn't that what every girl was supposed to want towards the end of the 90s? Like,
yeah.
Everyone wanted to be a pop star. And no, she just wants to write other people's songs. That's where her talent lies.
Yeah. And like, there's a really like sentimental moment in the movie that really works for me where she talks about, she's talking to her boyfriend and about
Kevin,
Mr. O'Donnell, where she says, you know, he's like, why do you want to be a songwriter? And she says, I remember the first time my mother played me the Bridge Over Troubled Water by Simon and Garfunkel. And I remember exactly what she looked like and exactly how her hair smelled. And now I listen to that song and I know exactly what she looked like and exactly how her hair smelled. And
it's a really nice line.
It's really moving, isn't it? And like the specificity of it being Bridge Over Troubled Water like really makes sense somehow, you know? It's really lovely. And then we have a nice long montage of her just getting slowly better at working at Coyote Ugly. Which I like.
Yeah.
Just her, you know, making drinks slowly better.
And no one cares that she's like smashing bottles.
Yeah. No one cares. And then eventually we get to this point where there's like, this is one of the maddest flights of fancy of the entire film, where there's a really wild night and like, you know, it's got out of control and men are like climbing over the bar and stealing alcohol and they need to do something or they're going to get shut down. And Violet gets on top of the bar and starts to sing
one way or another. But I think as well, like one of the bartenders is being like carried off, like despite her very vocal protest by like a group of drunken sailors.
Yeah.
And there is like the entire purpose of the scene is to convey uncontrollable danger. But for, like somehow there just isn't that much of a threat in the film. I can't really describe the strangeness of like, it's like, it just objectively is like a load of drunk men like preparing for a sexual assault.
Yeah.
But the film treats it very lightheartedly.
Yes.
And then Violet gets up on the bar and starts singing. And I do feel like this is like, I mean, like I enjoyed this scene. Like I'm not saying I watched it in this very po-faced way, but like rationally, that is the most extreme distillation of like the ludicrously optimistic hopes of that kind of tail end of third wave feminism. That like, you know, men are dangerous. Okay, there's this dangerous scene in the bar. But if Violet can just find a way, if she can just find that like mode that is going to control all the men around her and get them to look at her and not be able to look away, then like all will be fine. Women will be in control again.
Yeah, if we can just mesmerize them with our gifts, then we will. Yeah.
So she picks Blondie, which is just a perfect, perfect choice for that moral dilemma.
And it's so, I just like, okay, the idea of, it feels almost like a Greek myth or something. Mm. It feels like some kind of like fall of a great empire. And it's like, and then a goddess came down and everyone was transfixed.
Like, and the men are genuinely hypnotized. Like, you know, for all the kind of like undertone of them being like very gropey and carrying bartenders off while they're kind of screaming to be put down. Yeah. Suddenly it just goes quite wholesome again where they're like, oh, look, she's singing Blondie. Isn't that nice?
Isn't that nice? And it's not as if like, if this were a thing where like, it was like a Tina Turner woman stomping up and down the bar and like, you would kind of believe that. Mm-hmm. You would sort of believe that everyone would just be so.
No, but it's more kind of folk culture-y almost. Like, you know, do you watch Peaky Blinders?
I have seen it.
There's like, I think in the first series of Peaky Blinders, like Tommy Shelby's love interest kind of like gets up on the bar and sings this like Irish folk song. And like, you know, all these men are just like deeply enraptured by it. I think it's almost like a kind of more traditional, like actually like, no, these men are all right after all. Like, they still love watching a woman carry a tune.
It's so, yeah, it also makes me think of the Titanic scene where Rose just gets up on her two toes.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, wow! You think you guys are so tough? Does this mad thing with her toes. That brings us to her getting fired from the bar. And all through this, Kevin is trying to get her to sing, and he's really pushing her to perform her songs. And then,
do you think he's too pushy?
Yes, I do.
I do.
Leave her alone. Leave the poor girl alone. You know. And like the whole cardboard cutout scene thing.
Oh my gosh! Can we talk about that?
Yeah.
This is extraordinary. So, like, to help Violet overcome her stage fright, Kevin takes her to, like, is it like a comic book store? Like, where is this space?
I don't understand where the space is.
It's some kind of space he's borrowed where he's just arranged some, like, cardboard cutouts of, like, David Hasselhoff and, like, Bill Clinton and Marilyn Monroe, just like a kind of Sergeant Pepper's, like, cast of famous people. And he's like, look, you know, they're cardboard cutouts, so you're, like, you're playing to an audience, but they're not real. So this will, like, help you overcome your stage fright. Like, here's a keyboard. Like, why don't you sing to me? But instead, she's like, no, I need you to understand and empathize with, like, how I feel.
Yes.
So she starts to do a little striptease where, like, the innuendo is that she's describing, like, how her stage fright works. She's like, you know, my heart starts beating fast. And she's, like, taking off her skirt. It's just bizarre.
It's so bizarre. I would love to know, like, what the thinking was of that particular scene, particularly when you consider this is a script that was rewritten so many times by so many people. And, like, at what point were they like, oh, no, that has to stay?
I think they were genuinely just like, we'll show her in control. Like, she's seducing him.
Yes.
That makes it good.
That does make it good. And this thing of, like, it kind of gets increasingly ridiculous, because it makes sense that she has stage fright when she's a girl from the city and she's very shy, but then
although she believes it to be genetic, which I'm not quite sure that's how stage fright works.
Oh, it's how it works,
is it?
And but then, like, she'll do, and that's the kind of thing, she'll do anything, but she won't sing her own songs. It gets kind of increasingly ridiculous. And then he gets her a slot at the Elbow Room, which is a very famous club. And she can't leave work because it's too busy. And then they have this whole fight, which, again, is a version of the script I enjoy. This kind of central question of, like, you know, you think you're like progressing somehow by, you know, singing with the jukebox every night, you're not actually pursuing your dreams. Which I always find those themes very interesting, I think. I think they're kind of weirdly universal for, like, millennial creatives, right? I think everyone has that thing where they've, like, I remember feeling this way in advertising, where I was like, oh, I can just make it as an advertising copywriter. That is enough adjacent to what I want to do. That it's enough and it will be enough and I'll find it satisfying. And then you never do. And then just kind of more time fritters away and you convince yourself that you've, like, feathered a nest somehow and you actually haven't. You've just given your best to something that doesn't matter and you don't care about.
But she does deeply care about Coyote Ugly.
She does deeply care about Coyote Ugly. She really does. And that scene when, like, you know, immediately after, really, like, the bad times really slam her in the face in that act of the movie. So she has this big fight with Kevin, and then she goes back into the bar because he's after making a scene in the bar.
Kevin punches a regular because he was getting a bit gropey with her.
Yes.
Which apparently she was
in control of.
Yeah. And apparently he has absolutely no right to be annoyed about that. I'm not quite sure how to feel about that scene. Because he says some unpleasant stuff to her about how slutty she's been, which, like, is not great. But also, she kind of says to him he has absolutely no right to be angry that, like, he's witnessed her being, like, really, like, aggressively sexually harassed. Like, of course he has a right to, like, express an opinion about, like, not wanting that to happen.
Yeah. It is difficult, this part of the movie, because, like, it suddenly has all the male characters coming in with their judgments about what she's doing. In between, her dad finds out that she works there, Kevin's getting pissy about it, and she says that she basically has the right to be sexually harassed as long as she kind of is in control of it, which is a inherently, like, oxymoron of a statement, you know what I mean? Her dad's screaming at her, he's ashamed of her.
Yeah.
It's really quite tough, and it's like, it's almost like for a minute the film can't decide whether or not what she's doing is empowering or not, almost.
I think it's just like another product of like the naivety yeah. at the heart of raunch feminism.
Raunch feminism, I love it.
Like, she's just like, when she sees that her dad comes into the bar and she's like shocked.
Yeah.
So like her first instinct is to be like shocked and ashamed herself.
He does come in on a bad day though, to
and
be
that,
fair.
Yeah, I mean, she's like covered in water. It's like a wet t-shirt contest.
It's not the best bring your dad to work day.
Yeah, but like... So, like, her instinct is to be ashamed and, like, cover herself up and run to him and, like, apologise.
Yeah.
And then he's like, well, I hate this. What are you doing? But then she kind of just says to him, like, you have no right.
Yeah.
Which, you know, like...
He doesn't
have a right, but, like, there's almost, like, this expectation that he can't even be slightly annoyed about it.
Yeah.
That there can't... Like, there maybe needs to be, like, a slightly more nuanced conversation yeah. about, like, sexuality and empowerment. But she's like, no, either... Like, it's an either or. Like, either John Goodman is ashamed or he has to be, like, completely sex positive about it. And there's no complicated middle ground.
That's so true. I feel like maybe instead of the cardboard cutout striptease scene, like, if at least one character had, like, any of the characters had an actual conversation about what they were doing.
Yeah.
And apparently those scenes did exist but were cut for cardboard cutout scenes. But then it's almost like, the film refrains from making a judgment because she has that thing with her dad and the thing with her boyfriend so close together. And then she's immediately fired. And it's like, I was like, oh, it would have been like so much better if she went on working there knowing the men in her life despised what she was doing.
Yeah.
But because she's immediately fired, it's like it almost like gets out of making its own judgment or having her make up her own yeah. mind.
But also she never has a chance to like have the experience of working there turn sour or like get yeah. boring.
Yeah, true. She does work there for about 4 weeks.
Yeah.
Enough to buy a Mac and get GarageBand.
I love that giant Mac.
I love that giant Mac. There was a real phase in filmmaking where every character, there was a moment where a character had to buy one of those Big Macs.
Yeah, to get involved in the internet.
Yeah.
This new thing,
the internet. Then she gets a big songwriting break. Good for her.
God, Can't Fight the Moonlight is such a banger.
It's such an odd song. It's like weirdly mid-tempo. Like it's such the sound of the noughties to me.
Mm.
Of the like the end of 90s pop where everything had that vaguely computerized-y thing.
Key change after key change after key change.
Yes. And, like, I do believe that, like, oh, this would be the song you'd sell, you know?
Mm.
And apparently it's, like, one of... This will be another one for Australian listeners, of which there are many. It was number one in Australia for, like, an insane amount of time.
Mm.
Which I don't know why that is, but...
It's a classic.
It's a classic. Oh, my God, that whole... We've went past it. That whole scene with Lil when she fires her...
Mm.
And it's really good. It's just really good because she sort of, you know, said, look, you know, I made the rules, you broke the rules. And Violet is like, why are these things about the rules? Like, get real. It's
just
a bar.
And Lil's like, why are you so upset then?
It's so good, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the one, like, really good dialogue scene that happens in that bar, I think. Do you understand why it's called Coyote Ugly, even after the explanation?
Not really. I genuinely think that must have been retrofitted, just because it sounded quite nice as a bar name.
It does. It does sound nice as a bar name.
I mean, that doesn't make sense. So, like, the story is that, like, it's an, you know, you wake up next to a guy, like a one-night stand so ugly that you'd rather chew your own arm off.
Than wake him up.
That's not a plausible premise.
What's always confused me is, he the coyote or are you the coyote?
You're the coyote. I think, like, if you were trapped, you know.
Do coyotes do that?
I think so.
Do they chew their limbs off?
Yeah.
Is that a thing?
I think if they're trapped, yeah.
Okay.
But it's not what they're known for, is it?
No. Or is it like, oh, he's so ugly, he's coyote ugly. Like, he's like... Ugly as a coyote?
No, he's not ugly as a coyote. The girls are coyotes.
Okay. Yeah. Yes, that's true, because they are coyotes.
Yeah.
It makes no sense. But then actually the film does kind of say it makes no sense, because...
I think someone says to her, like, why did you call the bar Coyote? And she's like, because Cheers was taken.
Funny. There's something you said in your email when we talked about this movie, which was that, like, this idea that, like, Lil is this matriarch of the bar and she's the only one who doesn't get up and dance. And it's like, she's 35.
She was 32, 32 when they filmed. But she, so apparently she had worked in, like, one of the bars, like, not Coyote Ugly itself, but she'd worked in, like, one of the bars they'd done research in.
Yeah.
So she had, like, danced.
Yeah.
Which I don't think they did in Coyote Ugly, like, the bar before the film.
Right, right.
So I think, like, the producers, like, hadn't put her in these dances, and she was like, yeah, but, like, I have professional experience about, like, of this, I want to join in. And they said, no, you're too old.
That's so fucking weird.
But, which I do think, like, we just don't talk enough about how massive this cultural shift has been in, like, how long women are allowed
to be
sexual. Like, I feel like this was, like, around the same time that Kylie's spinning around, you know, that amazing video of her in the gold hot pants. And I feel like all the media narrative of that was like, oh my God, she is so brave. This is so daring. Like, a mature woman, you know, wearing such short shorts. But, you know, I guess she's got it. So, like, good for her.
And how old was she? Was she in her 30s as well?
She was also, I think, like 31, 32 when that came out.
I remember thinking, though, like, I think we're the same age. You're 31.
I'm 31.
Yeah, same. Like, yeah, when, because I was too young when Kylie came back with Spinning Around to know that this person was coming back from anything.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't remember the whole Neighbours stuff or anything.
She was like an elder stateswoman to our generation.
I felt like she was my mum. I felt like she was a thing for my mum, and she was my mum's generation. Yeah. Like, I felt like she felt really old to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so did Anastasia. Remember her?
I do, yeah.
And, like, basically any pop star that wasn't 19 felt like an ancient, strange beast.
Yeah, that would be, like, that. There was such an obsession with, like, female precocity as well. Like, definitely, like, conversations around Britney.
Yeah.
But, like, I don't know, the film has such a strange... It's not just Coyote Ugly, but the film has such a strange relationship with age. So, like, you're at 32, you're too old to be sexual, you know, in like, noughties cultural universe.
Yeah.
But then I think, like, one of the actresses who played... The Russian tease, I think.
Yeah.
I think she wasn't 21 when it was filmed, so she had to get, like, a fake ID to be able to, like, do research for the film. Leanne Rimes, I didn't realise.
17!
Like, she cannot get into a bar to do, like, a gig, you know. But we're just expected to just view this all as, like, completely normal.
It's so strange.
By the time you're an adult, like, you're too old to be sexy, but we're just, like, accepting that, like...
Yeah.
Kind of underage people are allowed to play full adults because that's the only way in which we can, like, sanitize them being sexy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there was definitely this concept of, like, you know, the camera adds 10 pounds in 10 years kind of thing. Because, like, you don't... That character you don't think of as being very young. I don't, anyway. I don't think of, like, oh, look at that baby on my screen, you know? It's really very strange. And this is also occupied the same moment... where, like, Charlotte Church was, like, 16, 17.
That was, like, the countdown to her 16th birthday.
Yeah. It was mad. And, like, basically the charting of her tits over the years was, like... It was so insane. This idea that this, like... This child that for so long was almost hailed as being, like... Like, God's artistic pop culture channel. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
This voice of an angel thing. This, like, holier-than-thou child performer. The quickness with which, like, tabloid culture wanted to wreck her.
Like Madonna whore.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, she's kind of a dream guest, actually, to get her on. I think she's have so much to say. And I remember also the kind of Emma Watson as well.
Yeah.
That whole thing of when will she be old enough so it's okay for her. Like, it was almost like these tabloids were presenting a question that nobody was asking and forcing us to ask it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, nobody was sat there thinking, when's Emma Watson going to be old enough that I can, like, reasonably masturbate to her? No one was thinking that, but they just made us think it.
But I just, like, the concept of virginity had, like, a bizarre amount of cultural salience.
It really did.
Like, it's so strange to me that, like, I mean, obviously I wasn't an adult in 2000, but, like, I'm trying to imagine myself, like, being... a young adult and just being asked on the one hand to be like, oh yeah, we're in this, like, very sex positive culture, like, yeah, it's liberating for me to read Playboy and, like, get up on the bar and dance, but on the other hand, this, like, huge kind of cultural prestige being put on virginity.
Virginity, yeah.
Which is what I quite like about Coyote Ugly, because I feel like this is around the same time that, like, Britney Spears was being kind of asked to kind of embody this, like, teasing virgin kind of media stereotype.
Yes.
And I quite like in Coyote Ugly, like, right at the beginning of the film, she's, like, talking to her best friend in Jersey before she goes off to the big city.
Yeah.
And her friend's just, like, she's kind of doing this monologue about, like, oh, we were always, like, the same because we had these big dreams, but we've, like, never followed through on them. Yeah. She's like, you know, we said we were going to go to college and didn't. We said we were going to, like, save ourselves until marriage and then we didn't. And it's just, like, a very nice throwaway line. Like, I feel like the film gets out of the way, like, any sense that we're going to be, like, obsessing
over whether or not
whether Violet's a virgin.
Yeah, yeah, which now the idea of that being something that's, like, revolutionary is mad.
Mm.
But then...
But it was culturally unusual, I feel.
Yeah, yeah, it was culturally unusual. My God. I just can't believe this is an era that we lived through.
I know, I can't. I really do, like, sometimes look back and just think, like, it was the Wild West. Like,
yeah.
What was anyone playing at suggesting that, like, this is... I just... That we grew up in this...
Yeah, that we're all just... Yeah. Like, and I do feel like, you know, to be a woman is to have your own kind of cultural brain damage. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I think of my mother's generation and how they were legitimately asked to go on the cabbage soup diet. And that was supposed to be a normal and healthy idea kind of thing. The idea of all those fad diets being sort of things you could easily just, like, buy in a chemist kind of thing is crazy to me. But I think
but
our...
I feel like the noughties really brought that back.
Do you think so?
Yeah. I mean, like, just the thinness...
Thin, yeah, yeah.
Extreme. Of, like, public women in the public eye in the noughties, I think, is extreme.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And if you think about, like, I don't know, like, the first time our generation heard what a blowjob was because President Clinton got one from his intern and she was the bad guy.
Yeah.
Like,
she
just
was the seductress.
Exactly. And, like, really not until a couple of years ago did people start to reframe that story as, like, oh, no, this is, like, a young, vulnerable woman. Like, it truly blows my mind that we were all brought up in this.
But at the same time, we were all asked to be like, oh, well, like, feminism's been solved now. Like, we achieved equality.
Yeah, do what you want, I guess.
Yeah.
Except not that or that or that. Patriarchy, hell of a drug. The weirdest thing about this movie, to wrap up, is that... We are given so many scenes of John Goodman eating fast food and being sort of vividly unhealthy. And then he's hit by a car. What's that about? Why do they tease the heart attack so much?
Well, again, like, I wonder if, like, John Goodman's character is just, like, a confused rewrite across several scripts. Because I feel like what is underplayed is his role as, like... the impotent gatekeeper to NYC. Like, his job is to sit in a toll booth... and
the
watch people going
gatekeeper.
To the city, like, day after day. But he doesn't want his daughter to go. But it's kind of like his job to wave her through.
Oh, I hadn't even thought of that. It's very beautiful.
And then he's hit by a car.
Also, the film is, like, quite old-fashioned in the sense that it posits that, like, New Jersey... moving from New Jersey to New York is, like, this crazy thing to do.
It's this very, like, Bruce Springsteen trope.
It really is.
I think they do, like, name check the weirdness of that trope at the beginning of the film, though, where her friend's like, she's moving, like,
42 miles. Mad.
Also how, like, you know, New Jersey is apparently, like, this incredibly safe place where everyone's in, like, very, like, thriving, close-knit communities. And apparently, like, New York is, like, terrifying by comparison.
Yeah, it's almost like a movie, like... written in the, like, late 60s or something. Mm. The idea of, like, New York, this, like, crazy dangerous place, and New Jersey is, like, this lovely suburban community. It's a huge, huge state. Then we get to her being in the songwriting competition, I guess. The Bowery Ballroom is doing a thing. They want her in. And this kind of rallies everyone round the last. And I genuinely teared up a small bit when she was going through the, what's it called?
The toll booth.
The toll booth. Yeah. and they lit up the things for her.
Yeah, they flash all the lights for her.
Nice.
I like how, like, every single person in that film ends up in some small way, like, enabling her to get to the Bowery Ballroom and sing her song.
Yeah, it's nice. Then they all close the bar to go see her.
Yeah.
I just wish, like, It's the same in like it is in Back to the Future as well, where it's just like there's like we've had all this tension and all these stakes, and then you're like, okay, what you want is the audience. You just want to just go and just sing the song. And like it's like, oh, we have to have this like 11th hour like car turnaround thing again, and she almost doesn't make it. It's like, I don't need this. We've had so many stakes. I just wanted to have a smooth ride to the Bowery Ballroom.
Although she is, to be fair, just like from start to finish in this film, just like genuinely unprofessional.
Yeah.
She has done no research into how industry works.
This. Yeah.
Like she's late to everything, she doesn't turn up to gigs. Like it is a miracle that she makes it.
A real miracle. The whole thing of like she's so upset when like people won't take her tapes, and like surely you only need to be told once that we can't accept unsolicited material, because then it could lead to like a da-da. Like it's a good policy. It's there, it exists for a reason. Do you know what I mean? And she just will not quit.
That does feel very of its time though, like you know, when like you try and get like your first job as a teenager, and your parents will be like, if you just go around with your CV, just keep handing your CVs in, and someone will give you your break in the end.
Oh my God. I was so that. I was so handing in CVs, and like, even when I first moved to London, I was trying to get a job in the creative arts, of just like turning up and like sending really elaborate like gifts with my job application.
Yeah. I think there's this like hilarious mythology of like, the person that proved that they wanted it enough by like turning up at the desk like every day for a month until like it was too hard to say no to them.
It's a real myth, isn't it? Like it's one of those things you because the people who tell those stories are the ones that made it, and they're such a minority. It doesn't really talk about like the deranged people who just keep showing up and everyone gets them removed by security and all that, you know? It is the sort of thing of like, it tries to make it seem like these extremely exclusive industries are, it's like a Wizard of Oz thing kind of thing, that you have to just really prove that you want it. When actually, more often than not, it is like narrowing corridors of privilege and nepotism that get people into those buildings, you know? And that's depressing. But what's not depressing is the final scene with Leanne Rimes.
Oh God, I love it so much.
Love it. I don't even care about Leanne Rimes as an artist, really. Do you?
I genuinely, until the other day, didn't realise that she'd started off as a country artist and that this was her...
She did the Taylor Swift trajectory,
That she, like, wanted to go into, like, becoming, like, a straightforward pop artist, and I think her label were like, no. So I think someone had offered her this song for the film and she jumped at it.
Oh.
But apparently no one knew the song was going to be, like, big at all.
Yeah. And it's like, it's weird because it's like, it's such a well-known song, but I don't think it's one of those movie songs like it's not like Don't Want to Miss a Thing or something, you know? It's not like one of those things that's completely translated into, you'll see it in, you hear on the radio all the time still. It still very much exists in the context of this film, you know? It hasn't, despite it being huge, it's not something you would just hear on the radio or hear on a jukebox or see on a mix somewhere, you know? It occupies a very strange place.
Karaoke classic.
Karaoke classic. Yeah. Yes. It exists so women can pretend to be in this film. Which is like, have you ever been to a Coyote Ugly bar?
I've not. It's genuinely not my thing. Have you?
I have.
Have you?
Yes.
What did you think?
Well, I went when I was 18. I was on holidays. My first kind of ever holiday with friends in Magaluf. They have one. And the whole thing exists so girls, it doesn't exist for men at all, which is funny.
It's like a kind of hen party destination.
It exists so that you can feel like you're in the movie.
Yeah.
And it's such a funny transference, because the whole idea of Coyote Ugly, especially in that Liz Gilbert article, is the idea that like, we are taking your money. It's a cynical enterprise to milk as much money from men as we possibly can. I think there's actually a scene where she does milk a customer.
She physically milks a customer. Like he's got like a latex glove full of beer.
Yeah. And then to have the reputation of Coyote Ugly go through the machine of this movie and then become a franchised bar, wherein it's not like, because a guy would just go to a strip club or he'd go to Hooters, right? It exists so women can feel like they can exist in the fantasy world of this film. Yeah. There's something kind of darling about it.
Yeah, I think, I can't remember who it was in that oral history that we read, but they were saying like they've been to like do openings at Coyote Ugly since, and they just really like just like watching women like get up on the bar, like not the bartenders themselves, just like people that have gone for the night.
Yeah,
like, they said that it just genuinely seems like there is something quite liberating and empowering for people about it.
There is, yeah. Like, I don't know.
I just can't dance. I think that's the only reason it's not for me.
My boyfriend says I dance like two pieces of seaweed under a rock, under the ocean, just like wafting around.
I think if I could dance, I'd be straight on that bar.
Yeah, yeah. I do. It's kind of a strange kind of alchemy the film discovered, almost. The idea that, like, when women get on a bar, they feel different. It's a bit like wearing a wig or something, or wearing glitter. It's like, it does something to you chemically.
I think it's a bit like, I went to an all-girls secondary school. Mm. I remember, like, you know, we weren't supposed to wear makeup, but if we were, like, caught wearing, like, makeup or nail varnish or, like, rolling up our skirts, teachers would be like, look, there are no boys here. Like,
Who are you doing this for?
And we'd be like, well, we're not doing this for men. Like, this is for us.
And it was for us.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and really finding that sort of, like, sexuality that in a very contained and safe way when you're that age. Is a real thing. Because I do think as well, talking about this being a sleepover movie, it's like, when you, especially if you, were you sporty when you were a kid?
Oh, not really.
Me, not at all, not even slightly. But like, so the first time I was aware I had a body was when, you know, when you're 13 and the first time somebody honks at you or when you're 12. Yeah. And it feeling scary, like really scary, because you're just like walking home from the shop or whatever. But also kind of exhilarating because it's the first time you're really made conscious of having this thing that has power.
Yeah.
And the next sort of 6 years of your life are just about trying to wrangle that power in a way that isn't dangerous.
Yeah.
And I do think that is part of, you know, a huge part of why this film will exist forever, you know, or versions of it. I can imagine it will get remade and, you know, probably with like girl band members in the title roles. And it'll always have a thing at the center of it that just makes sense and feel safe, but also like a fantasy.
And all the women have each other's backs.
Yeah, that is the important thing, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Even like, even the bitchy one, played by Bridget Moynihan, i.e. Natasha, is like, she's like an Amazon. Like, she's a bitch, but she, you know, you get a sense that she's like a law keeper, you know? There's something...
I feel like the film completely ignored the trope that was kind of compulsory in films about female friendship for a very long time, which was... women are going to have to overcome their innate cattiness and jealousy of each other to realise that they can eventually work together as a team.
Yes!
But, like, there's none of that in
the
film.
No, and it's like that character, I can't remember the character's name, but I know she's played by Bridget Moynihan. She never, like, comes round to liking Violet.
Well, she's just haughty. It's not like any sense of rivalry or anything.
No.
She's just a hard-ass bitch.
She's just a bit of a bitch, and she thinks that Violet's a bit wet, and Violet is a bit wet, and they're never going to be friends, but they have a loyalty to each other.
And she does punch the guy who heckles her
See?
In the Mary Ballroom.
But they're never going to get brunch, and that's fine. Right, Hannah, we should probably wrap up. Do you have anything that you're writing, working on, that you'd like us to check out?
Yeah, I do. I've just finished writing a book. It's called Rural Nostalgia, A Backwards History of Britain. And it's a tour through 5 centuries of British history, looking at the way in which we look back to the past. So there's plenty of sentimentality in there.
Oh, it's so exciting.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming on.
Oh, I should say it's out in May.
Oh, it's out in May. With who?
With Ebury.
Oh, very nice.
Thank you.
This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. You can follow me on Twitter at Zaroline, that's CZAROLINE, or email me about the podcast at sentimentalpod@gmail.com. This has been a Justice for Dumb Women podcast. Thank you to Harry Harris for the jingle, Gavin Day for the artwork, and Hannah Varro for the mixing.